This is the second set of the tape, a continuation of the interview with Mr. Rennie, R-E-N-N-I-E, of Ottawa.
What about, assistance that he might get as a local candidate? I'm thinking here in terms of family. Would Mrs. Perks come at any time to these meetings?
Oh, Mrs. Perks has attended many meetings, and she's been very gracious any time that she's been present, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. We have always had, at least during the campaign, we've always had at least one garden party, and we always held it in the gardens of their own home.
Oh, no.
And Mrs. Perks was the hostess then,
mm-hmm.
and it was very, very happy affairs.
She would be assisted, I would imagine. She would have to be assisted by other ladies in the association.
Oh, the ladies in the association, absolutely. Yeah, sure. But, any time she's been there, she's been most gracious.
Would she normally campaign with him?
Going away or going out of town or anything, home be driving up Ireland and places like that, yes, she used to come. As a matter of fact, my wife would go too, and it just sort of made a fourth of it.
Mm-hmm.
But on those occasions, yes, she would go with him.
Would she ever make a speech herself?
Oh, no. She never made a speech. Oh, no, but she was always very happy and very glad to meet anyone who came along and would speak to anyone.
Mm-hmm. What about his mother and his sister?
His mother was an invalid, of course, and of course she couldn't get out to do anything. You know, she was an invalid. She's a very elderly lady. I don't know whether she's alive yet.
No, she's dead.
She's dead now.
Yeah.
Well, then that leaves Hilda, his sister. And, Hilda spent most of her time at home with her mother, because someone had to be there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So they would be more or less out of it?
Oh, yes. Out of the picture. In a political sense, an active political sense, let's put it that way.
Yeah. What about in the sense of perhaps being part of a working gang called together to lick envelopes and mail them out or anything like that? Would she have to wait there? Or
no, we never requested her, as I recollect, mm-hmm. to do anything like that, because you've got to give consideration to what an individual is doing in the daily life.
Mm-hmm.
And when one is caring for the home, yeah. and an invalid mother,
mm-hmm.
To me, it's asking too much.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just asking too much. Yeah. And I would never consider asking her. Mm-hmm. Although I am satisfied that had she ever been asked, she would gladly have assisted. But I always feel you've got to take all those into consideration when you're asking someone.
Yeah.
You wouldn't ask a mother to leave her children at home, for instance, mm-hmm. and come down to campaign headquarters and let the children run wild while she was addressing envelopes, mm-hmm. or getting mail out or something.
Mm-hmm. Who were the, would you say, who were the staunch supporters of Perks in his riding? Again, I'm thinking of, shall we say, the period from about 1951 on. And indeed, among these people, you have mentioned some over the phone, whom I might inquire further.
Oh, yes, you can contact.
Yeah.
Yes.
But who you mentioned only three or four. There must have been...
Oh, no, of course, Drake and Wooten, for instance, they were in Victoria riding.
Oh, I see.
They weren't in our riding at all. Uh-huh. The only reason I gave those names were they knew him as an individual.
I see.
And knew, well, possibly a little bit, which they couldn't help but know.
Yeah. What about in his own riding then?
In our own riding, frankly, without my lists, I couldn't give you many names at the moment. Mm. And I have no lists because when I came here, I left left everything political behind me.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say this in all sincerity, that every member of that executive, or these executives, because they change from time to time, and membership of the organization, and many, many people outside the organization, were most staunch, and they get out and work. And when the campaign was over, well, that was, it was over. They didn't ask for glory, for reward, or anything else. They felt they had done a service to the riding and to the country as a whole in helping to elect
a good man.
Yes, but even I didn't stand out. I was on one of the teams.
Yeah.
We all worked together. All of us.
What was your hardest fight?
With George Burst, it was no really hard fight.
No, but I mean, who was your, well, let's put it another way.
The last candidate that we had for that riding, who stood after the by-election when George was elected Lieutenant Governor of the province, George Chatterton came along as the candidate. And that, I think, was one of the hardest political fights we ever had. But there was no hard fight with George Burks.
Well, to twist the question around, who, in your estimation, was the best Liberal or NDP candidate that was put up against Burks?
Well, there were some good candidates against him, and I feel individuals who would have been good representatives of their party had to be elected. They were not so well known as George Burks. They didn't have the association of the following with them. Therefore, it was a rather hard fight for them. But it was Dr. Thomas of the NDP, a schoolmaster. Now, he fought hard and he fought clean. But it was a hard fight all the way with him. And he never was elected at any time. But he was an individual who would have made an exceptionally good representative of his party. Now we had Duncan McBride, who represented the Liberal Party at one time. Now, Duncan was a grand person. He had a good sound knowledge of the principles of liberalism, and he stood high in the community. I think his fight, this is only my views of it, but I think his fight there was more against his own age than it was against the anything else.
What was his age?
Well, he was well into his 60s. Oh, well, he must have been, oh yes, he must have been about 67, 68, I think. And it was age more than anything else, because this was the first time he had stood. And you can't go into politics at that age and expect to come through, although he made a good fight. And then there was David Groose, Captain Groose.
Oh, yes, yes, he's a good one, isn't he?
Yes, and David put up a good fight, and it was this clean, healthy fight.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of humor with David in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, good-natured rubbing in respect to him being a candidate. And he lost out too. However, he is now the Liberal member for Victoria.
Yeah.
And I, as far as I understand and can see, he's doing a very good job.
Mm-hmm. What about Chatterton? You mentioned the difficult fight that he had. Now, had he been, he would have been, I would think, on the Conservative executive prior to this time?
No. George had nothing whatever to do actively with politics. He couldn't, because he was the agent or the district authority, if one might call it, for the Veterans Land Act for Vancouver Island, and was a federal government civil servant. So that he couldn't enter into federal politics. But he had and was Reeve of Saanich, and was an exceptionally good Reeve of Saanich. And therefore, there was considerable popular appeal where George was concerned. But then again, he was up against David Bruce, and David had ingratiated himself with a lot of people out there. And there was a bit of a ding-dong battle.
I'll bet it would be.
Yes.
Well, on the campaign circuit, can you think of any particular humorous things that you might remember that may have come up?
Oh, there's been an awful lot of them, but at the moment I just can't recollect them at the moment.
Perhaps if you do think of them, you'll write me, because I'd like to get some humor in, because I know them, it must exist with him.
Oh, yes, it exists. The there was one other candidate. What was it? Alistair Fraser. He was the son of the Lieutenant Governor of Nova Scotia.
For heaven's sake.
He came out there. No, who was it? I think it was 57. I'm not sure, but I think it was 57. My recollection isn't too clear of it. Mm-hmm. But he ran as a Liberal candidate out there in Esquimalt. And I think that was when we had just about one of our biggest majorities.
Is that right?
See, he was what one would call a carpet bagger.
Yeah.
Come in overnight.
And he was accepted as a candidate.
The Liberals put him up there. The Liberal Party put him up.
And this is rather unusual, isn't it?
Well,
for that sort of thing to happen?
Of course, I don't know how they operate, so that I can't say.
Well, wouldn't it? It would be unusual for the Conservatives.
Oh, yeah, we wouldn't stand for anything like that.
Yeah.
No, we wouldn't stand for that. But he was in there 1 year, Alistair Fraser. I think Jimmy Sinclair of Vancouver, he was the individual responsible for him. You know, remember, he was Member of Parliament for Vancouver.
Yeah.
He was the one responsible for Fraser coming in.
Yeah. I see. Well, if any humor escapes you for the moment, can you think of any incidents that may pop into your mind with respect to campaigning, the car breaking down and you not being able to make a meeting, or a slip of the lip when he's supposed to say one thing and he comes out with another, or anything of this nature?
then a car comes. And that was one thing we made sure of, that the car was in top shape all the time.
Yeah, and lots of gas, eh?
And I can't recollect at all of any... George would tell many humorous little incidents in his talks to the constituents and so on. Mm-hmm. But to recollect them would be foolish on my part, because I just couldn't bring them back.
Yeah.
I couldn't bring them back at all. But everything seemed to go along very quietly and very serenely. What we were more concerned about was not so much, shall we say, getting George elected, as what was going to be the overall score across the country.
Yes.
You see.
Yeah. You had a...
Because we were building up all the time. And we went in full of confidence.
Mm.
And just like a golf game, it's never over until the ball's in the hole.
Mm.
But we admit that.
Mm.
But going into those campaigns, we were satisfied. But we worked and worked and worked, never let up.
Mm.
Even though we knew or were satisfied within ourselves that the outcome was already settled and George was going back, that was no reason or excuse to let up. Everybody had to work and keep on working as if he were a candidate standing for the first time. That was how we approached our campaigns.
Well, that certainly sounds like a very sound and obviously a very successful method. I mean,
it's the only way you can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the only way. No matter, so a man has been in there for the last 20 years, we would still approach it.
Yeah.
At that time.
Yeah.
We would still approach it as if he was standing as a candidate for the first time and we had to give him everything because everything was needed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how we sailed along.
There would come a time, well, of course the time did come in 1958 when he became a cabinet minister. I think
no, 57.
He became a cabinet minister in 57.
57. He was Minister of National Defence in 57 when a minority government.
That's when the first Diefenbaker
government.
And he remained until when? 1960, was it?
October 1960. In October 1960, he resigned to take over as Lieutenant Governor of the province.
Why did he resign? Any idea?
Oh, his political days, let's be honest about it, his political days were finished. Many times he had mentioned to me, Harry, why don't you take over? Let me get back to my garden.
Yeah.
He was a great lover of his garden.
Yeah.
And he asked me many times if I wouldn't take over.
Of course, by that time, 1960...
Oh, no, he asked me back in the 50s.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. He asked me back in the 50s.
I'm just trying to think that when he actually did retire in 1960, he would be 60, 70, he'd be 72 years old at that
72
time.
72 years of age, yeah.
Yeah.
So you see, he had a long life,
yeah,
and a good life.
Yeah.
And he has added to it since he has gone back west.
Yeah. With amazing, still amazing vitality.
Oh,
just
yes.
Amazing vitality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But again, what the original intent of my question was, again, I'm looking at this pretty well from your point of view. When your when your candidate is not only an MP but becomes a cabinet minister, what does this do to you? What problems arise here, if any?
To me, it became heavier, much more heavy, because as a cabinet minister, his time was occupied fully with his department. And...
Oh, he would be in Ottawa the year round, too, wouldn't he?
All the time. And the result was that he was limited to many things down here. They came back on me, and I had to get, well, to establish, shall we say, certain things out there at the coast within the riding, and then advise them of the progress and how things were being done and what was going on and so forth. And keep them advised all the time. He was an exceptionally good letter writer in that he always answered the letter, no matter how simple it was or how complicated it might be. He would give you an answer anyway. But it did throw an extra weight, quite a heavy weight on me when he was accepted in the cabinet in 57.
You would have to become his...
Well,
more than his shadow, you'd almost have to become his substance.
Out there. And, my practice suffered for it, one thing or another, but these are things that happen.
But what were you doing yourself?
I was practicing, I was an accountant.
Oh, I see.
I had my own practice. But, you know, when these things come up, you're sometimes away for a whole day at a time, and your clients never see you, you never see them, and you're out in the evenings, and there's no home life.
Yeah.
It makes it rather rugged.
Would there be any reaction insofar as the services personnel are concerned? I mean, here you have a case where your candidate is Minister of National Defense from a riding where you would have a fairly strong service vote.
No, I can't say that there was. You see, a lot of people have a mistaken idea in respect to the Esquimalt Saanich constituency. Esquimalt is represented merely by the county or that territory of Esquimalt, but it does not take in the township of Esquimalt.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You see, and therefore there are many, many people who are resident in Esquimalt who are service personnel, but they don't have anything to do with the Esquimalt Saanich riding. They come in under Victoria.
I see.
Victoria has the two places.
Yeah.
You see. And although we have had things, but there's the usual routine for the service personnel to follow. And he knows it. And the service boys never very rarely will ever break it. They know their routine. And they're not going to go behind anybody's back and approach the minister about something like that. And I don't think there was any troubles in any way, shape or form in that respect.
Well, now, during the period that he was Minister of National Defence from 1957 to 1960, there was a growing feeling in Canada regarding the way that national defense matters were being handled. For one, I can remember myself, the Liberal government were hollering about the indecisiveness of national defense, so on and so on. Now, what is the score here? What could Perks do here, or could he do anything, or was it Stephen Baker, or what?
Well, you're back to a situation. Take for instance that CF-105 that was scrapped. I think that's partly what you have in mind,
just
and things like that. Now, there is a Minister of National Defense, and rightly or wrongly, he has got to bear the brunt of everything that takes place under National Defense. Doesn't matter whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. He's got to take the brunt of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now he has his chiefs of staff, Navy, Army, and Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
He has all the individuals who are projecting the requirements for the various services in there. Now that all comes up to his chiefs of staff. His chiefs of staff come to him and say, well, here is the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. He accepts that. Now, the decision is either his, or it is his in consultation with his cabinet colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
But he still is the Minister of National Defense,
mm-hmm.
and he still has got to bear the brunt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he goes in there. This is more or less hypothetical, because I wasn't in the cabinet, so mm-hmm. I can't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
But he goes in and he lays the facts on the table. All right, so the discussion takes place. It's settled. Now then, as Minister of National Defense, he comes out and he makes his statements.
Mm-hmm.
You may not like them. I may not like them. But the fellow sitting opposite us might like them.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's two people damning him and there's one person praising him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But whether he's right or whether he's wrong, he's still got to take the brunt because he is the Minister of National Defense.
Would you call him a forceful Minister of National Defense?
I didn't have any reason to have anything to do with his duties as a cabinet minister. His duties as a cabinet minister were, as far as I was concerned, of a confidential nature, and therefore I had no business or no right knowing them.
Well,
he would never break that confidence.
Aside from any,
but I think he did approach his job with complete sincerity, and was determined that when he made a decision, that decision stood. I would say that if yeah. all that being forceful.
He told me once, I forget how it was, but it seemed to me that we were talking about something or other,
mm-hmm.
something that had recently come out. Oh, I know, I think we were talking about integration, because I'm a...
Integration of the forces, yeah.
Yeah, and he mentioned when I was preparing, setting up this thing for an interview with mm-hmm. him, that there were a number of things that Hellyer was doing that he had suggested,
yes,
that should be done. And I gathered from him, from some other remarks that he made, that that they weren't done, evidently partly owing either to Diefenbaker's indecisiveness, or they were turned down, or something of that nature. Now,
well,
I'll let you comment on that.
No, go ahead.
Well, this is in part what I mean by being forceful. In other words, to have ideas, to have reforms, if reforms are necessary in mind, to be able to ram them through, to be able to get them accepted. Now, maybe this isn't a good definition of being forceful, I don't know.
Well, in bringing that point up, I did talk with him in respect to the colleges. That is RMC, Royal Roads,
mm-hmm.
and College Militaire Royal St. John.
Mm-hmm.
And asked him why they were not being retained as they were originally established, and as everyone expected them to be retained. That was RMC for military, Royal Roads Navy, and College Militaire
Air Force. Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, it isn't just as easy as that. He said, the integration of the three colleges was done by the Liberals before we took power. He says, a letter was signed, sent out, and that was it. And it's not just as easy to rescind the signing of a letter.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a point of integration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we asked him about the other integrations, and he said, oh, we are going about it slowly. Well, I think he mentioned the chaplain forces and the medical and the dental, more or less the supernumerary forces to the services, would be amongst the first that would be taking place.
Mm-hmm.
But I, as far as I was concerned, I didn't push him because he was a very frank and a very honest person.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very careful about questions that I asked him because I didn't want him possibly to say something to me in confidence, and then possibly I might pass it out. But I do know that the present Air Chief, or rather Chief of Staff, Miller, was at that time the Deputy Minister of National Defense. He was out of the services completely.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes, he was out completely. And George was the man who took him out of the civil service and put him back into uniform, and in so doing made him Chief of Staff. Now, his reasoning for that, I don't know.
Will you, well, let's put it this way, and again, I can only ask you this as a as an individual, because I fully realize that since you were, anyone who was not a member of the cabinet really can't guess. What would you say were his most progressive acts, his most imaginative acts as Minister of Militia, or Minister of Defense?
I don't know that I know of any specifics
mm-hmm.
that I could mention to you. It may be that just I can't bring them forward at the moment,
mm-hmm.
or there were none, but at the moment I just cannot.
Well, one thing that the Conservatives were criticized for quite loud and long in the more recent election was over a military matter, the Bomarks. Mr. Diefenbaker's indecisiveness or his failure to make up his mind one way or the other whether to take or not take. Now this would still remain, this would be a question also during Perks's time as Minister, I would think.
Yes, as Minister of National Defense, that was during his time, because he was still there until October 1960.
Yeah.
Now, how he had it set up. I know he was very friendly with the military advisors in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. But just what he left behind him for Mr. Harkness to pick up, and whether Mr. Harkness was not prepared to pick this up, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And whether commitments had actually been made by Mr. Perks is something that I can't say.
Yeah. Again, this is a period that I haven't questioned him on.
No, it's one of these sort of the theoretical things that you might get an answer to and you might not get an answer to. But I don't know of anything in respect to actions or decisions that he had made in that respect.
Yes, this is a 3-year period actually where it's really, I suppose, not fair for me to question you on. I'd have to question himself first and possibly some of the people who were
Doug Harkness.
Close to him at the time,
Well, Doug's still in town here.
Is he?
Doug's in the house. Oh, yes. Doug's
good. I must try and get him.
Well, you'd have to. What date is this?
The date is the.
Well, you'd have to get Doug. I think Doug's on the Veterans Affairs Committee. I'm not sure. But if he's on the Veterans Affairs Committee, he'll be leaving on the 25th to go overseas on the trip.
Oh, yeah.
With him. But Doug is in town.
Do you think he would speak to me?
Oh, Doug would talk to you, sure. Surely. I don't know what he might say or what he might not say, but Doug Harkness is an exceptionally fine person. And he's always been very frank. I've had occasion to talk to him on several occasions. Mm-hmm. And he's always been very frank and very honest in anything he's had to say.
Well, by then, I think I'll write him a little letter, because I have a sort of a general letter of introduction from General Perks
mm-hmm.
to just about anybody I want to approach. I had been asking you a considerable amount, and I thought I should reserve a little time to see if there's anything that you may wish to say in any respect about your relationship with Perks, or anything that might add something to a biography of him.
No, just very little. Very little at all. Our relationship was most friendly. We always got on well together. There were differences of opinion in many cases. But they were resolved quietly. And without any upset in any way, shape, or form, we had no trouble. There was only one thought that I had in mind. Possibly this may come as a surprise to you, but George had always been the critic of the Department of National Defense.
Mm-hmm.
When they were in opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Diefenbaker is a very, very loyal person.
Mm-hmm.
And he's loyal to those who are loyal.
Mm-hmm.
And George, along with many others, was a very loyal person. When it came to appointments, it was natural that the critic for the party, and the man who carried the ball for them, if we might say, should get the first opportunity of being Minister of National Defence.
Mm-hmm.
He did. Now, this is a personal thought. And I've wondered many times, I've mentioned it to him, we didn't come to any decision, it was just more or less passed over. But is a professional serviceman, irrespective of whether it's Navy, Army, or Air Force, is a professional serviceman the best choice for an appointment as Minister of National Defense?
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I question it.
Yeah.
I don't question him, and I don't question his loyalty, his integrity, or anything he did. But it's just the basic problem of is. And I don't think a professional serviceman should ever be in the office of the Minister of National Defense.
That's a good question. A good question.
He has leanings, he has views, he has projections that an individual coming in from another level of life wouldn't have. And the other person coming in, he finds himself seated here. What's the job? Navy, Army, or Air Force doesn't mean a thing to him.
Yeah.
It's National Defense.
Yeah.
And that is why, as I say, it's a personal, personal thought with myself. And I have felt many times that it might have been better if George had been in another portfolio and someone foreign completely to the professional service been in National Defense. None of that may seem strange.
No, no, not necessarily at all. Because, as you say, frequently a person coming in, especially for the first time, with an absolutely fresh view. Now, I would imagine that in General Perks, despite all his good qualities, that there would be a sort of a traditional Army point of view. And this iron core, or steel core within him, coming at a time when the entire concept of war is changing at a tremendous clip, did he keep up? Could he appreciate it?
Or could he appreciate the projections of his staff?
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
I don't say he couldn't do it. Please don't.
Yeah.
Please
yeah,
don't take things up.
Yeah.
But it was the it's the thought behind it.
Well, I think you and I deserve a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, if you're interested. What do you think?
Well, if you feel like it.
This is the end of the interview, and a darn good interview it was. The remainder of this tape will be taken up with both documents, which I'm reading from the war diaries of the Seaforth Highlanders of Canada.